Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
The ranks of the Senate Republicans in New York have been greatly diminished over the past year with losses in the November elections and other GOP senators saying this summer that they are seeking new jobs. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt takes a look.
Republicans held the state Senate for nearly a century with only a pair of two-year breaks when the Democrats gained power. But that ended last November when the GOP lost 8 seats. They now have just 22 Republican senators to the Democrats' 40 seats. When the GOP lost the majority before, it was by a much narrower margin, and Republicans had always won back enough seats in the following election to regain control of the Senate. The state Republican Party chair, Nick Langworthy, says he believes that can happen again.
I start with the premise that if we lost it in one election, we should be able to gain it back in one election.
Langworthy admits, though, he faces tougher odds the next time there are statewide elections in November 2020. In addition to 2018's big losses, other Republican senators have left or are trying to leave. The Senate Finance Committee Chair Kathy Young won re-election, but she exited the Senate in the first months of this year's session for a job with Cornell University. Young had tried unsuccessfully to become the Senate's minority leader. Senator Bob Antonacci, the former Onondaga County Comptroller, was elected to fill the seat held by longtime Syracuse-area Republican John DeFrancisco. But Antonacci is now on the November ballot to be a Supreme Court judge. Two Western New York GOP senators, Robert Ord and Chris Jacobs, say they will run in a primary for the congressional seat held by embattled Representative Chris Collins. Collins has not yet said whether he will seek re-election. And at least two other Republican senators have expressed concerns over a new rule that could end senators' ability to earn any significant outside income after next year. George Amador, a builder who represents parts of the Capital Region and the Hudson Valley, has not yet said whether he'll seek another term. And Senator Tom O'Mara from the Elmira area, who also has a private law practice, is one of several lawmakers who have filed a lawsuit against the ban on outside income and has not yet made a commitment to seek re-election. Langworthy says he can't blame GOP senators who are in the minority for leaving for better opportunities.
When you're in a minority situation, it's more difficult to, you know, keep people and retain them if they see another opportunity to advance their career.
But Langworthy says he's optimistic and hopes that in the local elections this year, he can begin to rebuild the party by fielding good candidates for municipal elections. And he says President Donald Trump, though unpopular with the majority of New Yorkers, does have a great appeal in some parts of upstate and rural regions. Trump will be at the top of the ticket next November, and that could help Republican candidates in some state Senate districts. Langworthy, who took over the chairmanship from Ed Cox in July, says he's actively recruiting candidates.
We are on a recruitment mission right now to find the best and brightest candidates, some new faces, some young faces. You know, finding more female candidates is a number one priority of ours.
A spokesman for the Senate Democrats, Mike Murphy, called Langworthy delusional. And Murphy predicts more losses for Republicans if they further tie the New York GOP to Trump and what Murphy says are the president's radical and hateful policies. A spokesman for the Senate Republican, Scott Reeve, says he agrees with Langworthy's statements, but he says it's premature to speculate on the future election plans for Senate Republicans and that members will make their decisions at the appropriate time. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chertok. You had an interesting conversation on your Capital Connection program with the head of the Conservative Party in New York. His name is Gerard Jerry Kassar. And the Conservative Party and the Working Families Party, Politics Make Strange Bedfellows, are separately suing over the issue of fusion voting in New York.
And well, they should. Here's the concept. all the votes get added up so that if you're getting votes on the conservative ticket as well as on the Republican ticket, it all adds up. The conservative party is very weak in New York. It doesn't have a lot of people. It doesn't get a lot of votes. But the Working Families Party, now that has turned out to be quite an alternative to the Democrats. And when they endorse somebody like Cynthia Nixon or others, that can mean a great deal to a candidate. Hence, along comes Cuomo, and he says, let's weaken these third parties. And that's exactly what he's trying to do, and that's exactly what is going on.
Well, from Fusion Voting, you also talked with Kassar about President Trump, the impact on New York, as well as the voting that has occurred in the past. He wanted to correct the record and point out that President Trump did better in New York than John McCain or Mitt Romney statewide in previous elections.
Well, you got to remember a couple of things. First of all, New York City is the big kahuna in the way in which voting happens in New York State. And New York City voters just hate the guy's guts, even though he comes from there. Yes, there are some conservative pockets around New York State. And yes, the conservative chairman makes the best case possible that there are people who like Donald Trump in New York State. But it's a very blue state. We see it in the Assembly. We see it in the Senate in New York. And we're going to see it in this election. It's going to be overwhelmingly a we don't like Trump vote. That's for sure. So he says what he has to say. That's what politicians do. But in the end, it just ain't so. Trump is very unpopular in New York.
One of the other issues that he commented on was a story that came out from Newsday, Yancey Roy, and by Antonacci of Syracuse, who is leaving his post in the Senate, Republican, for a judgeship, and the idea that many of the Republicans, which used to be in the majority in the Senate, may be jumping ship as a result of being in the minority.
That's right, David. We always knew this was going to happen. You know, it's quite heady to be in the majority. You get to be the chairman of a committee. You get to call the shots. People kiss your feet, and it's a really nice job. For years, the Democrats have been on the other end of that, the losing end of it. Now the Democrats are in control. And of course, all those people who enjoy the perks of the majority are saying, who needs this? I sit in my office. They gave me an office that's not as good as the old one. I have to sit there and I have to pretend with my constituents that I count for something. When basically, if you're in the minority, you don't.
This week, Alan, a law took effect that further decriminalizes marijuana in the state. Of course, the failure in the last legislative session was what looked like was on track for a while, the legalization of recreational use of marijuana. We're also finding out an article in the Times Union last week tracking, and we've been talking about this on this program, not only just everyday folks, but medical marijuana patients in New York are flocking over the border to Massachusetts because there's more options and it's cheaper.
Hey, David, don't tell me. I live in little Great Barrington, Massachusetts. It's a small town. It's got 7,000 full-time residents. It has laid hands on five. It has legitimized five marijuana dispensaries in Great Barrington. Now, only one of them is up. It is so popular that it has brought an extra, in the first 7 months, an extra $1 million in taxes to our little town. New York State is losing a great deal of money by continuing on this. And people are flooding over the border through Hillsdale and Egremont and into Great Barrington. And we know that that's the case. And Great Barrington isn't the only place that is having this legitimacy of weed and of marijuana and of many of the extracts that come from marijuana. Hey, I actually used it myself for my bad back, not the kind that gets you high, but something called CBD. And so, yes, I believe that if New York doesn't get on the train, which it will have to do sooner or later, they'll continue to lose money to Massachusetts.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. State and local officials gathered recently in downtown Albany to highlight legislation awaiting the governor's signature that addresses the issue of vacant and abandoned buildings. More from the Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas.
Blighted buildings are commonplace in upstate New York cities. Municipalities have different ways of dealing with decay. The city of Albany maintains a vacant building registry, marking questionable buildings deemed unsafe with a red X. State Assemblyman John McDonald of the 108th District is calling for final action on a bill that passed both the Senate and Assembly during the legislative session. The Democrat says it would cut the period of time of the residential foreclosure process from 2 years of delinquent taxes to one.
It means tax foreclosing entities like Albany County, like the city of Troy, like the city of Schenectady, can move these properties to new owners, to hopefully new stewards, whether they auction it, whether they sell it, whether they transfer it to the land bank, which Albany County has been doing a great job with here in the city of Albany. They have many different options. For far too long, these buildings have depressed property values in the neighborhood. For far too long, it's caused nightmares for first responders and public safety members. And for far too long, these buildings have also been buildings where criminal activity, drug activity, can find itself a new home. And the intent of this process is to shorten that period, to transfer these properties, to help improve property values here in the city, to help improve the quality of life in the neighborhood.
Assemblywoman Pat Fahey of the 109th District says the sooner these properties are back on the tax rolls, the better.
Especially with roofs caving in, with more infestation of rodents or whatever the case may be, and we have seen some really terrible results because of this. I know the land bank has done some amazing work, but that is not enough. We definitely need to do more.
Albany County Executive Dan McCoy says this legislation will speed up the process of saving properties and save money at the same time.
In 08, when the recession started, more people abandoned their homes. In Albany County, we end up with the properties. And the other issue that we have in Albany County, we keep the city taxes and school districts whole in every municipality. So that becomes another burden to us that we have to pay for everything.
Mayor Kathy Sheehan says the Albany neighborhoods where many of the red X's appear have suffered from the cumulative impact of decades of racism, discrimination, redlining, and bad public policy.
This reduction from 2 years to 1 year is really important, and I do want to stress this isn't about foreclosing on houses where you have somebody with a catastrophic illness, mom goes into a nursing home, there's been a death in the family. Those are all things that we're working on a policy level to address and focus on within the work that we're doing around vacant buildings. But the other piece of this is the county legislature now has to agree to move faster as well. Right now, it takes 3 years of delinquent taxes in most instances before the county will foreclose, and that foreclosure happens in the fourth year. So we need to work on looking at strategic areas where we can do some pilots and really greatly accelerate that process so that we can get these properties into the hands of the land bank faster, at a lower cost, and with the ability to turn them around and rehabilitate them more quickly.
Rich as a party is the governor's senior advisor.
Governor Cuomo has enacted some of the strongest laws in the nation to help communities combat the scourge of zombie properties, and will review any legislation designed to build upon and further strengthen these protections.
As a party points out that roughly 900 bills passed both houses at the end of the session, and 746 remain.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
First-term New York Congressman Antonio Delgado from New York's 19th District held a conference call with reporters this week. He spoke about what he did during his in-district work week and weighed in on President Donald Trump's pass on attending a G7 climate meeting. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn has more.
Monday's session on climate, biodiversity, and oceans at the G7 summit in France included an empty chair, as President Trump chose not to attend. 19th District Congressman Antonio Delgado says the U.S. should be leading on combating climate change.
To know that we are not leading, and not just not leading, but that we are ultimately pulling ourselves out of the conversation altogether, I find that profoundly disturbing. And I will continue to call on the administration to take this threat serious, to heed the science, and to understand that if we don't, we will continue to be disadvantaged considerably.
Delgado mentioned that he recently introduced with fellow Democrat Mark Pocan of Wisconsin the Green Jobs and Opportunity Act, intended to ensure there is a trained workforce ready to help transition to a clean energy economy. The bill serves as a roadmap to achieve net zero carbon emissions by 2050. Delgado sees lots of growth opportunities for training locations, such as at community colleges, where it would be useful to invest in pilot programs for green jobs. Delgado's legislation includes 35 original co-sponsors. He says it brings together labor unions, educational institutions, green employers, and environmental advocates, and makes significant investments in targeted programs.
And I think if we can at least begin the process of investing in this kind of program, and not just reach to the community colleges, but reach beneath the community colleges to the high schools and to the middle schools and develop apprenticeship programs and weave into the curriculum how we can educate our young people for these types of jobs for the future, I think we'd be better off.
On August 23rd, President Trump signed Delgado's Bipartisan Family Farmer Relief Act, which expands the debt that can be covered under Chapter 12 bankruptcy from just north of $3.2 million to $10 million. Delgado's 19th district is home to almost 5,000 farms, 96% of which are family-owned.
And listen, during this down farm economy, with the tariffs, the trade war escalating, it's one of those things for me that is critically important so we can provide real relief for our farmers.
Delgado fielded a question about any forthcoming federal regulations on hemp and CBD, or cannabidiol, which is derived from hemp and a growing business in New York.
We did meet before the recess with folks at the USDA to talk about the next steps in this space. And my understanding is that in the coming months, there will be an interim final rule that will hopefully provide some clarity on, you know, the sale and distribution of hemp and sort of the manner in which folks can proceed with the understanding that its application is legal.
Asked whether he has thought about campaign strategies against Republican Tony German, who recently launched a bid for the 19th district in 2020, Delgado replied,
"I haven't."
Delgado then said he is focused on the work at hand. Delgado held a town hall Monday night in Rensselaer County, his 23rd since taking office in January. He intends to hold many more. Delgado said he spent the better part of last week focusing on priority issues for senior citizens.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. There are over 105,000 medical marijuana patients in New York. However, that number lags behind many other states, including Florida, which has over twice as many patients in half the time. In addition, many New York medical marijuana patients are flocking over the border to Massachusetts to take advantage of cheaper and more alternatives. There's also the issue of the number of medical conditions that qualify for medical marijuana. In part two of my interview with Lynn Parodnik, a medical marijuana doctor, we talk about those conditions on the list and those that are not.
Anxiety is not a qualifying condition. So if that gets passed, that'll really up the medical program. The other thing is New York really has to work on improving the products available. They have a nice lineup, but there's a lot more out there. And what their posting really is not strain specific. As we know from a lot of research, there are some strains that really work well with certain diseases. For example, Harlequin works very well for people with dementia. It's a CBD dominant strain, and seniors with dementia tend to respond very well. No paranoia, mellow day, they're more responsive, they're moving better, they're feeling better. Yet, I'm theoretically not allowed to offer that to them at all. I'm not supposed to even mention it. But my feeling is that education is comprehensive. If I feel somebody could benefit from the education, my job is to relay the information.
I guess at the base of all this is this marijuana plant that grows in so many different places around the world, and yet on New York's list, it is not there. Not only is it not there for purchase in terms of, let's say, the state regulating and growing its own and making it available where it is in other states, but one of the other equalizers here would be if everyone were able to grow some.
I couldn't agree with you more. If patients could grow their own medicine, the price for them is really, really minimal. How great would it be that you could just go in your backyard and you have what fits your needs? Or in the winter, you have your little closet equipped to be able to take care of yourself. Then the price really comes down for a patient when they grow their own. And that isn't even in the recreational bill. Massachusetts allows for it, and patients really, really benefit.
Let's talk about prohibition for a moment. We know, I think, from history that the numbers did tick up after the prohibition and then repeal of alcohol. And we may, and I think we're seeing some of this now, see that in some of the states that have legalized recreational use of marijuana. The critics will say, you know, we're going to create a nation of marijuana smokers. Of course, we talked about stigma already, but let's take that as it is. Your thoughts on this issue?
My thoughts are we're already a nation of marijuana smokers. What is new? Let's do it legally. Let's do it competently. Let's do clean products available to people who are over 26 years of age for recreational usage. There's also a lot of press about cyclic vomiting and emergency room visits for people using marijuana. If you look at the documentation of these visits, they're not from dispensaries, the products purchased. It seems that in the vape cartridges, the oils can vary, and there's a lot of tainted product out there. So if we become a nation of conscious marijuana consumers, that wouldn't be such a bad idea, as long as people are willing to respect that they are not able to drive, use heavy machinery, and all these other stipulations that we use with alcohol. Marijuana is far less toxic than alcohol. There's no liver destruction. People function better. It is really a much nicer, healthier way to go. I do not believe in excess use. I always say with patients, my job is to make you comfortable, not send you to Mars. But there are people out there who are using this stuff, whether it's documented, undocumented, but people should have availability of clean products.
Yes, many of the law enforcement agencies, of course, are worried about this issue of driving impaired. And as of yet, we don't have as accurate as we can, a system in the moment to determine whether you are driving impaired.
Exactly. What happens is that people who are questionably impaired or pull over, they have to do the little walk to see if they're impaired or not. If the officer feels they're impaired, they then have to pee in a cup, and THC stays in the urine for up to 30 days. THC is actually stored in the fat cells, so even if they are not under the influence, they will test positive. So at this point, we really don't have an adequate way to test for active substance in the body. So it really becomes an important social piece that people understand they can harm other people in their cars. They're not to drive. There should be a designated driver, the same rules and regulations that we use for alcohol. It shouldn't be so hard.
Well, we thought it wasn't going to be so hard, of course, for New York to follow suit. Everyone felt that New York was certainly going to have, including the governor, was going to have a recreational marijuana legalized in New York by the end of the session. That did not happen, of course, and perhaps New Jersey was a forewarning. when they didn't pass their recreational marijuana bill, that New York was going to have trouble, which in many regards centered around not only the law enforcement piece and what we were just talking about, but also the social justice area, that so many minorities and others who got caught smoking pot suffered prison sentences, long sentences, while others not so much.
Well, exactly. That's actually the bill that was in the New York Senate. It wasn't totally rejected. The first step was to take care of minorities, make situations available for them, have them have first crack at the dispensaries. That was what was enacted, and that's what we're living with at this point. I actually met with Peter Horkum, this senator who's handling the recreational marijuana piece in the Senate. He will be having that as part of his table. And we've gone over it, and he's really trying to do it in a correct fashion, doing the recreation with in mind what's gone on in other states. And he really felt strongly that they were not adequately prepared to do it right. So I don't see anything wrong with taking a step back and using more time to do this in a correct fashion. They're not saying, no, it's not going to happen. They're saying, we want to do it correct.
Well, let's use that word correct. If we're going to have the correct way in a perfect world, if you were to snap your fingers, I'm guessing that the major piece of this, split into, let's say, A and B, is the federal government's approach to marijuana. And that leads to whether or not these new businesses will have banks to hold their money.
Well, that's actually very interesting, because I heard from Ms. Maloney, she's actually working in Congress in Washington to get a banking statement done so that dispensaries can use banks to have their money. Right now, dispensaries are considered illegal, so they can only accept cash or debit cards. They are not allowed to do standard banking. Now, it's pretty crazy that they are sticking cash in the ceilings, in mattresses, all kinds of crazy, crazy stuff in 2019. So it's looking like this is going to happen, and it's looking that it's going to happen as a bipartisan cooperation, which would be very, very nice. It'd be actually ground-changing in this environment.
That's Dr. Lynn Perodnik, a medical marijuana doctor in New York. And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1935 or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.